"And what business have you here?" she continued. "It is not your place. Mary and I sit in the kitchen sometimes, because at home we like to be free, even to license. But you are a visitor and must go into the parlour." "I am very well here." "Not at all, with Hannah bustling about and covering you with flour." "Besides, the fire is too hot for you," interposed Mary. "To be sure," added her sister. "Come, you must be obedient." And still holding my hand, she made me rise and led me into the inner room. "Sit there," she said, placing me on the sofa, "while we take our things off and get the tea ready. It is another privilege we exercise in our little moorland home, to prepare our own meals when we are so inclined, or when Hannah is baking, brewing, washing, or ironing." She closed the door, leaving me solus with Mr. St. John, who sat opposite, a book or newspaper in his hand. I examined first the parlour, and then its occupant. The parlour was rather a small room, very plainly furnished, yet comfortable, because clean and neat. The old-fashioned chairs were very bright, and the walnut wood table was like a looking-glass. A few strange antique portraits of the men and women of other days decorated the stained walls. A cupboard with glass doors contained some books and an ancient set of china. There was no superfluous ornament in the room, not one modern piece of furniture, save a brace of workboxes and a lady's desk in rosewood, which stood on a side table. Everything, including the carpet and curtains, looked at once well-worn and well-saved. Mr. St. John, sitting as still as one of the dusty pictures on the walls, keeping his eyes fixed on the page he perused and his lips mutely sealed, was easy enough to examine. Had he been a statue instead of a man, he could not have been easier. He was young, perhaps from 28 to 30, tall, slender. His face riveted the eye. It was like a Greek face, very pure in outline, quite a straight, classical nose, quite an Athenian mouth and chin. It is seldom, indeed, an English face comes so near the antique models as did his. He might well be a little shocked at the irregularity of my lineaments, his own being so harmonious. His eyes were large and blue, with brown lashes. His high forehead, colourless as ivory, was partially streaked over by careless locks of fair hair. This is a gentle delineation, is it not, reader? Yet he whom it describes scarcely impressed one with the idea of a gentle, a yielding, an impressionable, or even of a placid nature. Quiescent as he now sat, there was something about his nostril, his mouth, his brow, which, to my perceptions, indicated elements within either restless or hard or eager. He did not speak to me one word, nor even direct to me one glance, till his sisters returned. Diana, as she passed in and out in the course of preparing tea, brought me a little cake, baked on the top of the oven. "Eat that now," she said. "You must be hungry. Hannah says you have had nothing but some gruel since breakfast." I did not refuse it, for my appetite was awakened and keen. Mr. Rivers now closed his book, approached the table, and as he took a seat, fixed his blue pictorial-looking eyes full on me. There was an unceremonious directness, a searching, decided steadfastness in his gaze now, which told that intention and not diffidence had hitherto kept it averted from the stranger. "You are very hungry," he said. "I am, sir. It is my way, it always was my way, by instinct, ever to meet the brief with brevity, the direct with plainness. It is well for you that a low fever has forced you to abstain for the last 3 days. There would have been danger in yielding to the cravings of your appetite at first. Now you may eat, though still not immoderately." "I trust I shall not eat long at your expense, sir," was my very clumsily contrived, unpolished answer. "No," he said coolly, When you have indicated to us the residence of your friends, we can write to them, and you may be restored to home. That, I must plainly tell you, is out of my power to do, being absolutely without home and friends. The three looked at me, but not distrustfully. I felt there was no suspicion in their glances. There was more of curiosity.
I speak particularly of the young ladies.
St. John's eyes, though clear enough in a literal sense, in a figurative one were difficult to fathom. He seemed to use them rather as instruments to search other people's thoughts than as agents to reveal his own, the which combination of keenness and reserve was considerably more calculated to embarrass than to encourage. "Do you mean to say," he asked, "that you are completely isolated from every connection?"
"I do. Not a tie links me to any living thing. Not a claim do I possess to admittance under any roof in England."
"A most singular position at your age."
Here I saw his glance directed to my hands, which were folded on the table before me. I wondered what he sought there.
His words soon explained the quest. "You have never been married. You are a spinster." Diana laughed.
"Why, she can't be above 17 or 18 years old, St. John," said she. "I am near 19, but I am not married. No."
I felt a burning glow mount to my face, for bitter and agitating recollections were awakened by the allusion to marriage. They all saw the embarrassment and the emotion. Diana and Mary relieved me by turning their eyes elsewhere than to my crimson visage, but the colder and sterner brother continued to gaze till the trouble he had excited forced out tears as well as colour.
"Where did you last reside?" he now asked.
"You are too inquisitive, St. John," murmured Mary in a low voice, but he leaned over the table and required an answer by a second firm and piercing look. "The name of the place where, and of the person with whom I lived, is my secret," I replied concisely.
"Which, if you like, you have, in my opinion, a right to keep, both from St. John and every other questioner," remarked Diana.
"Yet if I know nothing about you or your history, I cannot help you," he said. "And you need help, do you not?"
"I need it, and I seek it so far so that some true philanthropist will put me in the way of getting work, which I can do, and the remuneration for which will keep me, if but in the barest necessaries of life."
"I know not whether I am a true philanthropist, yet I am willing to aid you to the utmost of my power in a purpose so honest. First, then, tell me what you have been accustomed to do and what you can do." I had now swallowed my tea. I was mightily refreshed by the beverage, as much so as a giant with wine. It gave new tone to my unstrung nerves and enabled me to address this penetrating young judge steadily.
"Mr. Rivers," I said, turning to him, and looking at him as he looked at me, openly and without diffidence. "You and your sisters have done me a great service, the greatest man can do his fellow being. You have rescued me by your noble hospitality from death. This benefit conferred gives you an unlimited claim on my gratitude, and a claim, to a certain extent, on my confidence. I will tell you as much of the history of the wanderer you have harbored as I can tell without compromising my own peace of mind, my own security, moral and physical, and that of others. I am an orphan, the daughter of a clergyman. My parents died before I could know them. I was brought up a dependent, educated in a charitable institution. I will even tell you the name of the establishment where I passed 6 years as a pupil, and 2 as a teacher. Lowood Orphan Asylum, sure. You will have heard of it, Mr. Rivers. The Reverend Robert Brocklehurst is the treasurer."
"I have heard of Mr. Brocklehurst, and I have seen the school." I left Lowood nearly a year since to become a private governess. I obtained a good situation and was happy. This place I was obliged to leave 4 days before I came here. The reason of my departure I cannot and ought not to explain. It would be useless, dangerous, and would sound incredible. No blame attached to me. I am as free from culpability as any one of you three. Miserable I am and must be for a time, for the catastrophe which drove me from a house I had found a paradise was of a strange and direful nature. I observed but 2 points in planning my departure, speed, secrecy. To secure these, I had to leave behind me everything I possessed, except a small parcel which, in my hurry and trouble of mind, I forgot to take out of the coach that brought me to Whitcross. To this neighbourhood, then, I came, quite destitute. I slept 2 nights in the open air, and wandered about 2 days without crossing a threshold. But twice in that space of time did I taste food, and it was when brought by hunger, exhaustion, and despair, almost to the last gasp, that you, Mr. Rivers, forbade me to perish of want at your door, and took me under the shelter of your roof. I know all your sisters have done for me since, for I have not been insensible during my seeming torpor, and I owe to their spontaneous, genuine, genial compassion as large a debt as to your evangelical charity. Don't make her talk any more now, St. John, said Diana as I paused. She is evidently not yet fit for excitement. Come to the sofa and sit down now, Miss Elliot. I gave an involuntary half-start at hearing the alias. I had forgotten my new name. Mr. Rivers, whom nothing seemed to escape, noticed it at once. "You said your name was Jane Elliot," he observed. "I did say so, and it is the name by which I think it expedient to be called at present. But it is not my real name, and when I hear it, it sounds strange to me." "Your real name you will not give?" "No. I fear discovery above all things, and whatever disclosure would lead to it, I avoid." "You are quite right, I am sure," said Diana. "Now do, brother, let her be at peace a while." But when St. John had mused a few moments, he recommenced as imperturbably and with as much acumen as ever. "You would not like to be long dependent on our hospitality. You would wish, I see, to dispense as soon as may be with my sister's compassion, and above all with my charity. I am quite sensible of the distinction drawn, nor do I resent it. It is just. You desire to be independent of us."
"I do. I have already said so. Show me how to work or how to seek work. That is all I now ask. Then let me go, if it be but to the meanest cottage. But till then allow me to stay here. I dread another essay of the horrors of homeless destitution." "Indeed you shall stay here," said Diana, putting her white hand on my head.
"You shall," repeated Mary, in the tone of undemonstrative sincerity which seemed natural to her.
"My sisters, you see, have a pleasure in keeping you," said Mr. St. John, "as they would have a pleasure in keeping and cherishing a half-frozen bird some wintry wind might have driven through their casement. I feel more inclination to put you in the way of keeping yourself, and shall endeavour to do so. But observe, my sphere is narrow. I am but the incumbent of a poor country parish. My aid must be of the humblest sort. And if you are inclined to despise the day of small things, seek some more efficient succour than such as I can offer."
"She has already said that she is willing to do anything honest she can do," answered Diana for me. "And you know, St. John, she has no choice of helpers. She is forced to put up with such crusty people as you. I will be a dressmaker. I will be a plain workwoman. I will be a servant, a nurse girl, if I can be no better," I answered.
"Right," said Mr. St. John quite coolly. "If such is your spirit, I promise to aid you in my own time and way." He now resumed the book with which he had been occupied before tea.
I soon withdrew, for I had talked as much and sat up as long as my present strength would permit.